Okay, I'm going to read this, but hopefully I'll read it in an interesting way. In this lecture, I'm going to tell some stories about a handful of people I've got to know over the course of my research in Sylhet, Bangladesh. In particular, I'm going to describe the various ways in which they're connected and disconnected from each other and from the global economy. Yet, whilst connection is my main theme, what I'm going to argue is that it is only certain forms of connectedness that enable what Amartya Sen refers to as development, as freedom. And indeed, that in focusing on connection, we must also consider its antonym, disconnection. The stories are set in four small villages in a place I'm calling Duniapur, plus a brief sortie to Burnley. The setting is notable not only for its long history of transnational migration, but because since 2007, the oil company Chevron has been operating a large gas plant there. That's the gas plant. It's also the place where I've been doing field work and visiting since 1987, so it goes back a long way, my relationship with the place. My last piece of research in the area, which finished last year, examined the impacts of the gas field. What follows draws on this, as well as the longer-term perspectives I've gained from my own ongoing connection with Duniapur over the years. The narratives are therefore part of a much larger story concerning global connections, their historical depth, and their power to create material, cultural, and personal transformations, as well as loss, rupture, and disconnection. All are tales of what Anna Singh has called friction, the awkward, unequal, unstable, and creative qualities of interconnection across difference. For a number of reasons, I'm describing Duniapur as being situated along the jagged edge of global capitalism. I don't mean by this that globalization or 21st century capitalism has yet to reach the area, or that there is a meaningful division between so-called first or third worlds. In 2012's landscape of rising powers, BRICS, Eurozone implosions, and American decline, it would be nonsensical to speak of fixed geopolitical divisions, a developed North versus an underdeveloped South. But even as some parts of South Asia celebrate rapid growth and industrialization, these have in turn created distinct forms of entitlement and exclusion. One way of conceptualizing the types of development created by corporate global capital is in terms of enclaves that incorporate only the most privileged. As James Ferguson argues, rather than global capitalism rolling homogeneously from cores of accumulation to peripheries of supply, it tends to leapfrog geographical space, creating bounded enclaves of modernity and development whilst leaving surrounding areas untouched. Ferguson cites the gated enclaves of oil companies in countries such as Angola or Chad as examples. It worked. This is an enclave outside the village where I did my field work. In Duniapur, a similar enclave has appeared in the shape of Chevron's gas field. Yet, whilst materialized by the high wire fence that surrounds the site, the edge I am referring to is metaphoric rather than physical, shaped by long-term transnational migration to Britain and labor migration to the Gulf, as well as the broader history of the area. The edge divides those who experience the benefits of global capitalism, material well-being, access to healthcare and education, secure citizenship, rights and so on, and those who don't. It zigzags across the globe, not simply separating geographical regions or countries, but demarcating groups of people in the same place. It might be crossed and recrossed by people in the same family or even by the same person at different points in their lives. In Duniapur, some people have successfully clambered over the edge, achieving a firm footing in particular places, works, and way of life. Others, however, remain on the wrong side. Some, having attempted to traverse it via migration or employment by Chevron, have been propelled back, unable to grasp the prosperity and modernity they desire, bruised, maybe even mortally damaged, to a world where the lack of basic needs is the norm and rights exist only in the abstract. It is these shocks and injuries that lead me to describe the edge as jagged, a dividing line which is largely invisible for those of us comfortably on the right side, but dangerous and destructive for the rest. But I'm jumping ahead. This is the denouement, not the start of my tales. So in the next, what proceeds, I'm going to give a bit of history, and then I'm going to talk through accounts around three different people and then one village before coming to some conclusions. Okay, so that's a map of Bangladesh, and I'm not allowed to move away from this mic, apparently. Sylhet, I can just... Sylhet has been linked to the global economy since the first days of the East India Company, For Dunyapur, though, it was employment at Calcutta's ships that would lead to its particular connections with Britain. By the beginning of the 20th century, some men from the area were travelling to Calcutta where they found work as seamen or Lascars. So you can see the riverine geography of Bangladesh and Sylhet, the area. It's at Hobbiganj, actually, is just slightly down a bit. All these rivers were linking people, possibly, we don't really know the exact history, to the big port at Calcutta where they got work. Chain migration meant that soon particular villages and areas within Sylhet had established networks of migration. These are now known as Londony areas. I don't know where this photograph is from. I got it off the internet, I have to confess. I think it's probably the 1930s. Most of the ships went to London's Docklands, where some of the men jumped ship. It's no coincidence that today's Bangladeshi community is situated in this very area, for example, East India Dock Road, you know. By the 40s, a small group of pioneering Sylhetis were working in the kitchens of London's hotels and restaurants. These men formed a bridgehead for the much larger group who were to arrive in the 50s onwards, not as Lascars, which is the name for the seamen, as they were called, but as industrial workers hired to assist in the post-war reconstruction of Britain. During this period, thousands of men travelled from Sylhet to the UK, usually to work in the factories in the North or Midlands. The connection between the region and Britain was so well established that by the 1960s, the British High Commission had its own branch in Sylhet town. At first, the men lived in shared houses in Britain, returning every few years to see their families. By the time I arrived in Dunyapur for doctoral fieldwork in the late 1980s, most primary migrants were in the process of reuniting their families in the UK. The focus of my study was on the effects of migration on the area, mainly to the UK, but also to the Middle East. Over the year and a half that I lived there, several families were in the process of reuniting in Britain. Migration wasn't an easy subject to research. Many families were involved in protracted immigration cases in which their claims of kinship were contested by the British authorities. My fieldwork was not aided by the British High Commission's habit of making unannounced visits to villages in order to check up on the immigration applications. What on earth was this young British woman doing nosing around? Not surprisingly, many people believed I was a spy. Whilst back in 1988, the term transnational migration had yet to seize the academic limelight. By the time of my fieldwork, British Bangladeshi transnationalism was well established, with a constant movement of people and things between particular Sylheti villages and British neighbourhoods. In Dunyapur, the signs of successful migration were everywhere. Those who had gone to the UK had made huge gains, buying up most of the local land and building big houses. Meanwhile, those who hadn't gone were the net losers. That's a map to show the Londony areas of Sylhet, the region of Sylhet, which is a really bad map because I probably can't even see the areas in red. Basically, nodes of Londony migration settled in particular areas of the region. Okay, that's an example of a Londony house probably built in the 60s or 70s. So it's a sign of wealth at that time. That's an example of a house built in the late 90s, early 2000s. This isn't actually from my fieldwork site, it's from another place, it's another area called Bishwanath. But there are lots of houses like that in these Londony areas. That's another Londony house. And that's the house of somebody that didn't go to London. Just to show you the degree of contrasts and the extent to which migration to Britain became the main arbiter of whether or not people had wealth. Okay. So, the first account I want to tell you about is, the first person I want to tell you about is Khaled. I first met Khaled when he was 7 on the day I moved into Talukpur in 1987. He was the youngest brother of my adoptive family. As you can see, a cheeky, gap-toothed lad who'd like to peek at me from behind the door but always run away when I try to ask him questions. The first weeks of my fieldwork were challenging. Anthropology is founded on the method of participant observation. Living in one place for a long time, getting to know people and participating in their lives. A deeply embedded way of learning via personal experience. In those first weeks, however, I could barely understand a word of Sylheti and was followed everywhere by large crowds of people. I was at sea, or more accurately, marooned in mud. It was the tail end of the monsoon and the place was a bog, with many family compounds surrounded by water and only accessible by boat. Khaled's family lived in what was known as Sarang Bari. This means the Bari, the homestead of a Sarang, and a Sarang is a ship's foreman, so basically the labour manager for group teams of men that went to work on the ships. It was an excellent place to start understanding the form and meaning of transnational migration. The patriarch of Sarang Bari, Abdul Sayyid, who's Khaled's grandfather, had gone to Calcutta in the 30s. As a Serang, he was a key figure in establishing local migration networks, taking relatives and neighbours with him. After his death in the 60s, the borough was divided between his sons into four separate households. So that's just to show he had four sons. Three of them went to Britain in the 60s in this time of getting work permits post-World War II. And one son, who is Khaled's father, stayed behind. So by the time I was in Serang Bari, there were two households there. Two had gone. Ruth Soyed's family were all there. Jamil's, one of them had died, and his widow and her sons were also living on the Bari. In contrast, Khaled's father, Ruth Soyed, stayed behind. I suspect he'd never much fancied life as a factory worker. He was a farmer at heart, overseeing the rice fields, caring for his cattle and doing things the old ways. Bows and arrows for shooting birds, bullocks for threshing rice, growing his own tobacco to smoke in his hookah, and reminiscing of the days of the British. I lived in Serang Bari for around 16 months, learning enough of the language to be relatively compos-mentis, making some good friends and learning as much about my own culture and its assumptions as those of Duniapur. By the final months of my fieldwork, I had mapped the connections and divisions between families and lineages, had an understanding of the complexities of local hierarchy, and had built up a picture of what transnationalism meant for Duniapur. I knew a bit about former public Islam, and a lot more about the hidden mysticism and saints that many people followed. As well as my field notes, I had piles of taped interviews, stories, and songs. It was time to go home. And then something surprising happened. During a visit to a neighbour, I was told that Khaled didn't have two older brothers, but three. Ask Khaled's mum about Samson, the neighbour urged somewhat spitefully. See what she tells you. When I broached the subject, Khaled's mother burst into tears. It was true, she said. A dramatic pause. She had not seen her eldest son since he was nine, nearly 10 years ago, when he left for Burnley with his uncle. It was good, she added, dabbing at her tears. He would earn money, support the family. I was aghast, not only at the collective effort of keeping such a secret from me for over a year, and indeed the extent of my naivety, but at what it must have meant to have sent a son abroad when he was so young. Only now did I begin to grasp the emotional implications of migration. It meant global connection, true, but it also meant rupture and heartache, the separation of husbands, siblings, and tragically, parents and children. This was 1987, skip to 2004, and Khaled is in his 20s. More connections have been made to the UK. Khaled's older brother Taj has married his Burnley cousin and runs an Indian takeaway. His US cousins manage similar establishments in California. Meanwhile, the sacrifice of Samson hasn't paid off, at least not for those left behind. He is barely in touch and never sends money. Technology changes the nature and content of transnationalism. These days, everyone owns a mobile. Whereas in 1987, people painstakingly wrote or got others to write letters to their relatives, sometimes waiting months for a reply, now Britain and Bangladesh are routinely connected for hours. Sylheti London and Londony Sylhet have become transnational communities par excellence. People are constantly moving between the nodes. Marriages are arranged, money transferred, deals over property and businesses brokered. Duniapur and its transnational outposts aren't two separate places, but, as a younger generation of researchers at Sussex, such as Benji Zeitlin, have shown, a single social field. There have been other changes. One of Khaled's sisters, who is married to her paternal cousin, himself the son of a Londoner, has married off her eldest daughter to a professional man in London. Her eldest son is training to be a lawyer. When I return every couple of years, there's new babies there, new toddlers, aunties on visits from the UK, a different family of poor relatives living in the rooms vacated by the Londoner cousins. Khaled, however, is still in Duniapur. His older brother, Taler, is busy looking after the land, but while he seems relatively settled, Khaled is desperate to get to the UK. Like so many young men of his generation, London or America seem the only way of imagining a prosperous future. This isn't him, by the way. This is a research assistant in another project. There are no opportunities here, they say. Seen through the rose-tinted specs of a wannabe Londoner, Bangladesh is for losers. I'm enlisted as a sponsor. Official letters are written. The family tell me he only wants to go for a holiday. I am sceptical, but I support him anyway. The application is refused. A few years pass. Khaled's quest continues. The family is seeking a British bride. He's desperate to leave the village and secure his connections to London. Then finally, things fall into place. His British cousin Mumtaz agrees to marriage, and Khaled is off, triumphant, the borderman waiting behind him, an imagined life of opportunity ahead. And so, whilst his father never went to Britain, his oldest brother appears to be an unsuccessful sacrifice to the god of transnationalism. By marriage to their cousins, both Khaled and his older brother connect to the UK, so the orange is the people in this branch of the lineage who've got to the UK via marriage. A year later, maybe 2008, I visit Burnley as part of my research on the gas field. Khaled has been there for 6 months and I'm expecting to see him at Taji's house. He is, however, notably absent. I meet Mumtaz, who's lived in Burnley since she was three. She's warm and chatty, but at Khaled's name rolls her eyes. Still in bed, she sighs. Eventually he turns up, silent and thin. He doesn't want to chat. As Mumtaz drives me to the station, she opens up. It's so difficult for Khaled, she says. The work is too hard, long shifts in the takeaway after a lifetime of ease in the village. He's not used to it. Worse, he's not bothering to learn English, which he'll need for the citizenship test. He can't adapt, she continues. Coming to Britain was a shock, compounded by this new style of marriage to a British girl who speaks the language fluently, can drive, knows the ropes. In sum, he's depressed. What can you do, she asks as she deposits me at the station. That's marriage, no? You have to work at it, trust in Allah. It's not some picnic in the park. Okay, that's Khaled. Mala Bibi. The next account involves a woman called Mala Bibi. Whilst Khaled and his brothers have established legal connections to the UK via kinship, Mala relies on kinship for her everyday survival. There were connections to the UK a long time ago, but paradoxically, the insecure nature of informal kinship connections has meant that for her, the link to the UK she might have had was violently broken. When I first met Mala Bibi, she seemed similar to other very poor people in the village, alarmingly thin and drawn, her sari worn and her small house made of mud and thatch. She was, however, a member of Khaled's lineage, with its ancestry of sarangs and leaders, a person of status who had fallen on hard times. Indeed, as I was learning, within some of the higher status lineages in which many families had successfully connected to the UK, there were others who had fared less well. Some had never migrated, realising too late how connection to foreign countries was to become the arbiter of material well-being and opportunity. As their cousins or even their brothers had left for the UK and used their earnings to build houses and, most importantly, acquire land, they had been left behind, unable to afford the rapidly escalating land prices and forced through their everyday struggles and credit shortages to sell up. By 1988, when I did my fieldwork, nearly all the land was owned by Londonese. Mala Bibi was thus in the anomalous position of being very high status but very poor. What had happened? Back in the 70s, Mala had married one of Khaled's paternal uncles, or rather, a cousin of his father. Like his brothers, Jofal Mir had gone to the UK, leaving Mala at home with their daughter, Leela. Disaster, however, struck. Jofal Mir never returned to see his daughters grow up or father more children, for he was killed in a fight in Oldham in the 70s. Legally, Mala Bibi was entitled to a British widow's pension, yet she never got it, for her brothers-in-law sold Jofal Mir's passport and papers. Without the papers, Mala could make no claim. Cast from their homestead in the row that ensued, Mala and Leela ended up living on marginal land by the river, arranged by Khaled's side of the family. There were attempts at getting the pension, a case adjudicated by the British High Commissioner in Dhaka in the mid-90s, but the claims were rejected. Legal connections to the UK denied, Mala had only one resource left, her connections to relatives who were morally bound to look after her, via small loans, the occasional meal, cast-off saris, and so on. Indeed, moralities of helping and looking after one's own poor are central to transnational exchange and have been an important part of my research. As an adopted member of the family, I was expected to do my bit. Like many other poor and landless people, distant cousins who are tracing a complex genealogy I found impossible to follow, Mala would frequently ask me for help, usually alone or after I'd finished my fieldwork and was returning on visits, cash donations, which would be strictly controlled and managed by Khaled's sisters, who'd instruct me on what to give to who. Many years passed. It was 2002. Changes had come to the village, funded by Londonee remittances. The road had been tarmacked and new houses built. There was a large secondary school on the road, and the bazaar, an area that in the 80s and 90s comprised of a few tea stalls, had mushroomed into a veritable mall. It was no longer unusual to see second-story houses. Some now even had indoor bathrooms and kitchens. One had smoked glass windows. Like many Londonese houses, it was empty. Monuments to the departed, as Roger Ballard has said, are similar migrant mansions in Mirpur, Pakistan. I received a message from Khaled's family. Malabibi's house had been destroyed by floods. Could I help? I transferred a lump sum via the British cousins. And when I next visited the village in 2005, she and Leela were living in a small concrete house with a tin roof, a tube well, and hygienic sanitation. Things seemed better. They had no formal connections, no job or links to the UK, but could make claims for help via kinship, whether fictive or real. Yet such connections are far from secure, especially for women whose claims on others are always tenuous and conditional. Yes, brothers should look after their sisters if their marriages fail, but if they choose not to or treat the sister badly, there is little she can do. Yes, Mala Bibi was lucky that she had connections to rich Londonese, but her position remained precarious, for her claims over resources were based on morality and social relations rather than legal rights. And then disaster. In 2008, Leela collapsed and died. It was in this year of loss and grief that Jochel Mir, another cousin who lives next door, made his move. During my original fieldwork, Jochel had been working in Dubai. He did well for himself, working his way up the ladder from labourer to shop manager. With his remittances, he'd built a large house and bought some land. Via his links to Dubai, he'd grown rich. And now he had plans for Mala Bibi's house, claiming it as his. The dispute that followed is instructive. Once again, Malabibi's membership of the most powerful lineage in the village saved her. In a village meeting, the elders pronounced the house as hers and reprimanded Jochel Mir. For now, at least, she was safe in the house, though without her daughter. Life remains hard for Malabibi, but at least she has connections. Her relatives couldn't save her from the aggressive actions of her brothers-in-law 30 years earlier, but they have kept her from total destitution, catching her in a net of obligation and moralities. The only resource she has. Okay, this is a brief theoretical digression now. So far, the connections I've described have been largely informal, based on social relations. In the early days of primary migration, men migrated via their social links to others, be these of kinship or neighbourhood. Later on, whilst there are legal hurdles to be overcome, the UK border is still traversed via social links. Khaled and his brother both married British cousins and gained settlement visas as spouses, the unions arranged by their families. Meanwhile, the poor are able to make claims on those with more resources via their social links, based either on genealogical relatedness or geographical proximity. All this is underlain by strong ideologies of duty and entitlement. The rich have a duty towards their own poor. When Mala Bibi's house, which she gained via her relationship with me, is threatened, the village elders act to protect her. These relationships and the ideologies and exchanges they involve have been described as social capital by theorists such as Putman. Social relations and personal networks act as the resource, the theory goes, providing access to food, credit, land, or work, and providing safety nets for the poor in times of crisis. It's an idea that's been seized upon by development agencies and politicians, a panacea for an absent or receding state. Who needs state welfare systems when people are provided for and protected by their social capital? Enter David Cameron's big society, stage right. Meanwhile, stage left, the anthropologist Pierre Bourdieu uses the term quite differently. For Bourdieu, social capital, knowing the right people, is about reproducing class hierarchy. Here, social capital works to maintain the elite. Via private schools, one's parents' friends, the networks established at elite universities, etc., the privileged develop social capital, which they then use to gain highly paid jobs and rise up the ladder. Seen in this light, nice social capital turns nasty. While Putman and Bourdieu's perspectives seem far apart, they describe two sides of the same coin. In Bangladesh, what appears to be nice social capital, in some contexts, the help that Mala Bibi gets, also appears as patron clientage in others, aiding the rich and keeping the poor in their place. And where the state can't be trusted to provide welfare or ensure people's rights, social capital can look very nasty indeed. If you have to know the right person to get something done, almost pay bribes to an uncle to ensure services are provided, then the cuddly kin-based system of claims and entitlements looks a lot like nepotism and corruption. Okay, this is a very old photo, as you can see. Along the jagged edge, about a mile away from Khaled's house, is the homestead of a very distant set of cousins, still seen as our own poor, but with the connection so distant as to be partially forgotten, at least by Khaled and his family anyway. Sophia Beebe's Barry is on the most marginal land in the village. Her widowed sister lives next door. Her husband suffers from a chronic illness, TB perhaps, for he's constantly coughing and complains of weakness and fever. Both sections of the homestead have been helped, in inverted commas, by their wealthy cousins, in particular the district chairman who gave them a strip of land in which to build their Barry, their homestead. They're a raucous lot. Sophia Beebe is constantly grabbing my arm and gabbling at me, poking me in the ribs for not being fat enough or shouting about my spots, whilst her daughters indulge in a peculiarly female form of torture masquerading as affection, the attempt to squeeze tiny plastic bangles onto my wrists. They're tiring, I have to confess, an observation which is enthusiastically endorsed by Khaled's sisters, who don't like them. They talk too much, I'm told, always making demands and generally not towing the line. Sophia's oldest daughter has raised eyebrows too. She wears makeup and jewellery in a way that is not quite proper. It is, however, at Sophia Beebe's place that I learn of dancing and drumming, Sufi trances and magical healing. We're in the late 80s, early 90s. Things aren't too bad. Sophia Beebe earns a patch of land and her oldest son Abdullah sharecrops more. Like many land-poor households in Bangladesh, they teeter on the edge of destitution, just about getting by via loans and gifts, scraping a living from the land, and without the cushioning of an extra bit of wealth, feeling the inevitable bumps. Illness, the marriage of a daughter, a flooded crop, an accident. All events which can, in the space of a day or week, cast a family deep into debt or worse. But like I say, they're okay. After considerable local gossip, the eldest daughter marries a man who works in Saudi. And now there is talk of Abdullah going abroad. Whilst passage to the UK isn't possible without close kinship connections or a great deal of money, migration to the Gulf is feasible. It's a gamble, though. An array of methods for getting to the Gulf exist, the least expensive of which is also the least reliable. To go legally, you pay for a contract with an employer, legal documentation, and the flight plus the agent's fee. It costs the equivalent of thousands of pounds, an investment in the global labour market that few can afford. Without such funds or the patrons to provide them, the options become ever more risky. Some men end up trailing through the Burmese jungle to get to Malaysia. Death by snake bite, exhaustion, or drowning is not unusual. Illegal migration. The tales are global in their reach, for just as people desperately want to connect to the heartlands of global capital, so are these heartlands desperate to keep them out. The stories are horribly familiar. The suffocating journeys in containers, the ill-fated crossings in leaky boats, or the mythical story of the Bangladeshi, always a cousin of a cousin of a cousin, who somehow hung onto the undercarriage of a plane and arrived in his destination in one piece, but having turned to ice. So it's not funny. So Abdullah's family opt for what they can afford, which is to pay an agent, a man who knows a man who knows a man, to get him to Saudi. It's a gamble, but they're buoyed with hope. The field is sold and loans taken from various Londony relatives. The agent takes a down payment, promises he'll fix things. He returns with paper that Abdullah, educated to class 5, painstakingly signs. The remainder of the money is paid. Abdullah will be leaving in a week. Perhaps I don't need to finish the story, for you can probably guess the ending. Abdullah makes it to Dhaka in newly acquired trousers and shirt. He doesn't, however, make it to Saudi, for the agent has cheated him. There is no passport, no ticket to the heartland of global capitalism, no chance. The land is sold, his family have nothing. I wish I could tell you how they bounced back. I wish I could describe how they reported the cheating agent to the police and how he was caught and the money refunded. Or even, in the ultimate fantastical tale, how they were protected by an insurance policy which reimbursed their losses. But none of this is true. Poor people don't generally go to the police in Bangladesh. They're seen as corrupt. Their service is reserved for those able to pay hefty bribes. There are no insurance schemes, little sense of rights or entitlements. What can we do, people say? It's written on our foreheads, our fate is bad. And so, 10 years later, Abdullah remains living in the hut he shares with his mother and sisters in its marginal position on the edge of the village. The land is gone. He worked for well as a busboy, but the bus crashed. He was injured. It didn't work out. He takes labouring work whenever he can, as do his mother and aunt. There are rows, some violent. The huts are increasingly wretched looking. Sometime in 2009, I meet his sister and her children sitting by the side of the road, surrounded by bits of dismantled housing, a thatched roof, a mud and straw partition wall, her home ripped down after a huge fight. She doesn't know where she's going, she says. Her marriage is over. Her family won't have her. She's become unstuck, torn away from the web of connections. I never see her again. Okay. And so to the gas field. And so, from the periphery of a Londony village, we move along the road to Kakura, about half a mile away, a quite different place. Here, 83% of households have no land. The rest have only a small amount. No one has migrated to the UK and no one is related to a Londony. Basically, the village was settled in the 60s from incoming labourers who came into the rich Londony villages to work as labourers. And then when they became too congested, the elders of the village settled this place, a piece of communal land slightly to the north. That's a photo which shows current incoming migrants into Talukpur. So the people in Kakura used to live in places like that until they were resettled up the road into slightly less temporary housing. Okay. Many worked for the same household for years, these labourers, and were known affectionately as Mama, which means maternal uncle in Bengali. No one ever went there, but their servants from Kakura seemed, on the surface at least, to be part of the family. Let us not be deceived by the romance of the traditional, however. The nasty underside of patronage, or social capital, was always there. Kakura had no school, no health facilities, and when the area finally became connected to electricity in the 90s, the lines went straight past them. As one man put it recently to us, we're left in darkness. The lines of social connection are constantly shifting. Whereas in the 80s, what we might think of as traditional patron-client relations were firmly in place. By 2000, things were shifting. In the next 10 or so years, fewer Londoners would return to support their own poor, and the local economy would become increasingly monetized. Land, for example, was increasingly rented out rather than sharecropped, which meant that in sharecropping, you harvest the land, somebody's land, and you divide the harvest between you. There's no credit put in at the beginning. Whereas when land is rented out, you've got to be able to pay for it to start off with. The change meant that in order to farm, upfront payments were necessary, which the poorest didn't have. Yet whilst these shifts were partly tied to wider processes of economic change reported over much of South Asia, as well as changes to the nature of transnationalism, by 2005 something much more dramatic had happened: the discovery and development of the area's natural gas. Initially, the development of the gas field met with substantial local resistance. In 2005, the district commissioner had arrived with a truckload of police and announced that the Unocoal were to develop the site. The land would be forcibly acquired by the government and rented to Unocoal. If people resisted, the DC said, they'd have their rapid action battalion and their reputation for death in crossfire to deal with. People were outraged. Even for those who don't own it, the loss of land spelt potential catastrophe. For everyone relies on it for their livelihoods, sharecropping or labouring on it, grazing their cattle on it, even using the straw left after the harvest for housing materials. People were also terrified of an industrial accident, like the one that took place at nearby Tangratilla that year. The blowout caused millions of pounds of damage, but was never compensated by the multinational involved. But perhaps the greatest slap in the face was that despite local demands, the surrounding villages were not to be connected to the gas. There it was, this source of energy and power, both literally and metaphorically, yet it was destined for other people and places. But despite these problems, the gas field also brought hope, especially for the people of Kakura. Representatives of Unocoal held community consultation meetings. There would be jobs, they promised, factories would be built, an industrial township might develop. Indeed, as leaders of the protest were pressurised to stop by the government and construction began, a large number of local people were employed in the building of the field. There's some of them, guys from Kakura, and these ladies. For a short time, 18 months perhaps, It seemed as if the benefits of global capitalism had finally reached Kakura. Not only were there jobs and regular wages, but health and safety training, legal-seeming contracts, and what appeared to be limitless corporate benevolence. For example, in their community engagement program, they had housing materials for houses that had been damaged by floods, road safety campaigns, they distributed smoke-free stoves, all kinds of things like that. But it wasn't to last. The connection was fleeting, the opportunities disappearing in a puff of flared gas. By 2007, Chevron had taken over from Unocoal, the installation was complete, and unskilled labour was no longer required. Gas fields need skilled technicians, foreigners driven past the villages in gleaming jeeps, not labourers. Apart from a handful of people who are related to the leaders now working with Chevron as contractors and partners in their community engagement programmes, the people of Kakura were laid off. If they were ever connected, now they were abruptly disconnected, cast back to the reduced pool of land to scratch a living. Combined with this, the high-banked roads. In fact, those ladies are taken at the bottom of a high-banked road. I was standing on a road looking down. Plus an embankment built at the Kushiara River meant a dramatic change to the local ecology. When I did my original fieldwork, the area was inundated during the wet season by the overflowing river, which brought silt and water to the land seasonally, vital for wet rice cultivation. But now the water no longer flowed, and according to the farmers, the land had dried up. To irrigate, one now has to access a power pump, which is yet another expenditure for small farmers and sharecroppers. The final indignity was, however, yet to be grasped. For, it transpired as the years have passed, Chevron does use some labour, but rather than employing people directly, they use contractors. And while some of these contractors are local, the majority are from distant regions, bringing the workers from many hundreds of miles away. The reason, as one contractor explained to us, is that the geographical distance gives him more control over his workers. They can't walk out or create a fuss. Indeed, they've paid him a deposit in order to get the gig. If they're disobedient, which is what he said, not only do they not get paid, but they lose the deposit. Working with contractors in this way, as Chevron's community liaison officer put it so eloquently, ensures an easy flow of labour. So, there are no jobs for the people of Kakura, at least not involving formal contracts with Chevron, with their ethical codes of employment, safety standards, and so on. What few jobs exist involve informal systems, a reserve army marshalled by patrons with links to the multinational. It's hardly surprising. Why would Chevron become mired in the complexities of local patronage? Far better to work with contractors who can provide the easy flow. The company don't want to be embedded in social relations, for they might need to move out quickly once the gas supply is exhausted or national politics become too tricky. This is what Jamie Cross, another Sussex Anthropology alumni, has called the corporate ethic of detachment, a process which, even as corporations claim to have partnerships with local communities, as Chevron do, as we'll see in a minute, they remain detached. In sum, there is no formalised employment, no economic development beyond the enclave of the gas field, and no connection to the gas. Instead, there's a rhetoric of partnership. I won't read it out, you can read it. It doesn't mean a lot, I don't think. This partnership involves a community engagement programme which offers alternative livelihoods, microcredit, training, income generation, goat rearing, bull fattening, broiler farms, women's embroidery, etc., etc. The programmes are run by a local NGO plus village development organisations which are made up of the local elite. Some people do benefit, gaining loans, goats, training, etc. Others complain that since they're not part of the village development organisation's network of their own pool, they've been excluded. The slogan that the NGO that is running these programmes for Chevron uses, and which executives at Chevron enthusiastically repeat, is helping people to help themselves. So that's a woman in Kakura who's part of the goat rearing program, helping people to help themselves. In sum, whilst the rhetorics of community partnerships suggest connection, many people in the villages surrounding Chevron's enclave remain disconnected. Okay, my conclusion. Whilst I've presented these short accounts to you as stories, in reality they are fragments, shards of rich lives and complex histories that I'm arranging in a particular way in the hope that their pattern might reveal something more. So what do they teach us? First, in places like Duniapur, connections to the heartlands of global capital are nothing new. Such connections, based on geographies of profit and loss, and arising in the form of migration or gas extraction, create particular territories of inclusion and exclusion, demarcated by the jagged edge. Abdullah attempted to cross it via his failed migration. Khaled did cross it, but he has been bruised by the experience. Finally arriving at the longed-for destination, Burnley, he finds new boundaries separating the haves from the haves not. The reality of life in the lower echelons of the restaurant trade hits hard. He sinks into depression. Connection brings disconnection. In his struggles to get to the Middle East, Abdullah loses his land, whilst for relatives left behind, migration brings permanent rupture. Khaled's mother lost her oldest son. His sister is pleased her husband is earning money in Saudi, but it's not much of a marriage, she says, for she only sees him every 3 or 4 years. For young wives travelling to their new husband's home in the UK, marriage can seem like a ripping apart, involving a journey of thousands of miles to an unknown country and in-laws they may have never met. Is it any wonder they weep as their families wave them off? Meanwhile, the slow disconnection of labour from the land continues. For the landless and land poor, it is increasingly hard to get a foothold in the agrarian economy. The prices are too high, and while sharecropping is giving away to rental arrangements, the prices charged are increasing. Seeds, fertiliser, irrigation all now require credit, especially now the local ecology has changed. And finally, there is Chevron, connecting to and profiting from the natural gas, but not to the locality via the provision of jobs. Land has gone, 50 acres in total, plus more for the roads, but the area remains disconnected from the gas and the power it generates. People speak of how once the gas has been pumped away, the land will be hollowed out and everything above collapse. The imagery serves as an apt critique of the global economy. The natural riches of the locality are pumped away, and as others profit, those left behind face ruin. So more conclusions. I think in Dnipro in particular, and Bangladesh in general, one has to have connections in order to access basic needs, let alone material comforts and security. However, these connections take two forms. The first are informal connections based on social relations. Social capital, both nasty and nice. It's these that keep Malabibi afloat, and these that have enabled Khaled to reach the UK. Similarly, it is these that ensure Chevron have an easy flow of labour. It's also informal connections of the Alternative Livelihoods Programme involved. Women's credit groups are based on their links and sense of responsibility to each other, while the VDOs plug into notional networks of patronage. But secondly, are formal connections based on legal contracts and rights. Everybody employed at the University of Sussex has these and takes them for granted. We don't need to know the Vice-Chancellor's cousin or pay the head of HR a backhander to get a job. Similarly, the state to which we are legally connected via citizenship provides the services which in Dnipro the poor can only largely access via the charity or help of their patrons. It is this that the characters of my stories are seeking and which lies on the other edge of the jagged edge. So, what is development? Having spent 20 or so years worrying about the term for all its inferences of naturalised lineal change and the problem of its discursive properties, I have decided that desirable change, for now let's call it development, entails formalised connections to the systems and territories of accumulation involving legal rights, not as an abstract concept, but secure and accepted processes in which claims can be made without recourse to ideologies of charity or kinship. Yet, ironically, much of the fashionable development practice that corporations such as Chevron ply in order to boost their global reputation for ethically and socially responsible business practice involves the opposite of connected development. Instead, the programs that look good from the outside and help people to help themselves involve what in my latest book I have called the disconnected development. Schemes that rely upon informal social capital for their success rather than enabling people to move beyond these to formalise connections to the state and the economy. Indeed, helping people to help themselves might be thought of as anti-development because projects that are geared at people doing things for themselves are premised upon insecure social capital rather than rights and legal entitlements. From this, perhaps rather than talking in lineal terms of development or the developed versus the underdeveloped world, third, verse, whatever, maybe what we should be talking of are differing types and levels of connection. Okay, final words. In our gathering of life histories, our observations of places, people and relationships, our notes and interviews, sometimes spread over many years, I hope that by now it is clear that anthropologists are doing more than simply arranging fragmented shards of disjointed stories. Told alone, nothing makes much sense. But once the broader context of history and geopolitics are added, the narrative takes shape. The trick, of course, is to show the interconnections and frictions, not just between one set of localised stories, but across the globe. Taken together, how do our varying stories add up? What do they tell us of how we are all interconnected? In Dunyapur, in the lives of Khaled, Malabibi, Abdullah and their relatives and neighbours, just as here in this lecture theatre, we have different forms of connection and different positions along the jagged edge. But for all of us, and for all the stories that are to be told, it's as Nadim Aslam writes of Afghanistan. Pull a thread and you'll find it's attached to the rest of the world.